is the City of Chicago. Mr. Levy?
Could you tell Collins that the Haven case is not the same as the Central Park?
Mr. Levy? Where are you?
May it please the court, my name is John Lovey, and I represent the appellant, David Haywood. And this is not a huge damage case, as your honors have undoubtedly discovered, but it's a very important case, because it's about the Fourth Amendment, and it's about the importance of the Fourth Amendment. And we quoted from Justice Frankfurter that the history of liberty in this country is largely the history of procedural protection. And that's what this case is about. And not only do they want to bend procedural protections, they want to throw them in the garbage. They want to say that they can submit to the court a fraudulent affidavit which purports to be signed by the complainant, which is not, and purports to be notarized by a notary, and it's not, and that in the name of officer convenience, they could submit that fraudulent affidavit and use it to detain somebody's liberty. They suggest that procedural shortcuts should be countenanced by the court, but this is more than a procedural shortcut. This is taking the oath, which is really one of the cornerstones of our judicial system, and saying that it's meaningless. And your honor should reaffirm the Fourth Amendment and tell Chicago that it has to reform that practice. And obviously our claim is divided into two, and the first claim is really the central claim, and that's the claim that the conduct I've just described violates the Fourth Amendment. And I believe we've shown step by step that our claim is a real claim. First, you cannot be detained in this country beyond 48 hours without some sworn evidence. And that's the Kalina case, that's Judge Moran's decision in Carter, where he explained that just as you have to have sworn evidence to get an arrest warrant, if not more so in a situation like this where there's an arrest without a warrant and then you go before a magistrate because the stakes are higher and because there's more time to get it right. And they argue that, well, you don't need sworn evidence to make that detention decision at a Gerstein hearing, but we've shown in our brief that that's just not the case. And indeed, it's silly, because if you had to get, you had to go before a magistrate and present sworn evidence to get an arrest warrant, what sense would it make that you could just bypass the process altogether, make the arrest, and not need sworn evidence? The second part of the claim is the Franks showing, and we've made that showing as well. First, I'm surprised that they take us on knowing falseness, because these are police officers who deliberately signed a name that was not theirs, signed a notary that was not theirs, and then not only gave it to a judge, but did it with the intent of misleading the judge. And how they can argue that that's not knowing...
When the officer signed the notary... That's very strange, the notary's name. Is there a notary stamp or something, or did he just...
There's not, Your Honor.
There's no stamp, so he just... Did he say notary public or something? Or
it's on the line on the
so
form.
There's a notary public line, exactly. So he signs the name of a notary public.
Which happened to be, in this case, a guy named Brumley.
Would that be known to the magistrate? I don't know.
There's no attribute.
But there was no stamp. There
no stamp. No, okay. But it's on the line that says, I'm hereby swearing that somebody stood before me and took the oath. And as I said, it wasn't just that they did it, but that they did it with the intent of concealing what they did wrong. They didn't put for attribution. The one guy, Maris, realized he wasn't going to be in court on the day when this was going to, when Haywood was going to be in court. So he didn't just leave it blank. He didn't just sign his partner's name and initial it. He misled the magistrate, the judge. He intentionally made it seem as if it was not. And that's not conduct that this court should condone. And their justification, in their own words, they put it that this is procedural shortcuts and that the Constitution allows procedural shortcuts in the service of convenience. This court should reject that, because the Chicago Police Department apparently does this as an institutional practice, and they obviously think there's nothing wrong with it, and they've come to your court and told you that they should be permitted to do that, and that's why it's very important that this court tells the Chicago Police Department that you can't mislead the judiciary. We cited a lot of cases where it is a, and this is obviously where the district court was with us up until the material point, but it is a material defect to have a bogus affidavit. And we cited case after case after case where when a judge learned that an affidavit in a civil case had been created under false pretenses and wasn't signed like it was supposed to be signed, the judiciary got indignant and got outraged and used phrases like fraud on the court and not only found it unconstitutional, but went even further and said, you should lose on this ground alone because you have perpetrated a fraud on the court. And this context is obviously even more serious. A, you have law enforcement officers doing it who are supposed to be enforcing the law. And what does it say if we let law enforcement officers disregard the law? And B, because this isn't a summary judgment motion, this is the determination used to deprive someone of their liberty. So we ask that on that ground, Your Honor's find that the practice and the conduct described here and admitted to here violates the Fourth Amendment and that Mr. Haywood's resulting detention should be ruled unconstitutional.
Was the contents of the document false?
Well, we believe that the contents of the documents were false because the signature was false and that's a material part.
Well, other than that, I mean, other than as far as the information conveyed to the judge.
I would concede that it was accurate. And, you know, that's their argument, that we could have done this correctly. But they didn't. That's like a police officer saying to a magistrate, I put false statements in an affidavit, but I could have put correct statements in there. Yes, some parts of the affidavit are true, but the most important part of all is, in fact, materially false. As for the other part of our appeal, Your Honors, we think this is an equally important Fourth Amendment concept, and that is, on the day of the arrest, these police officers claimed that they detained Mr. Haywood because he didn't have a proper city registration. For summary judgment purposes, Rule 56, that is belied by the arrest report, the case report, the property inventory report, all of which were say these guns were cleared, registered, there's no registration problem. In fact, one of the police officers testified much later at the arraignment that the guns were properly registered. So they had no basis to detain him based on the facts known to them. They want to be rescued after the fact, by the civil discovery that the attorneys did in this case, where they dug into the licensing and they deposed people and they really got to the bottom of what it takes to carry a gun. And then after the fact, they learned that Mr. Haywood wasn't carrying a TAN card.
Before you get to the TAN card, with regard to the hour and a half, the violation of the hour rule, so they knew that he wasn't going to get to work within an hour, apart from the arrest, and we now know, they didn't know the legal significance of that, we now know the legal significance, so that's an argument, but do I understand you to be arguing that they waived in the district court reliance on the hour and a half as a basis for the legality of the arrest?
I would argue that, Your Honor, because they failed to put it in their interrogatory responses, but it's more than that. It's that they only learned of the significance long after the fact. And they tell you in their deposition, that didn't mean anything to us. What time he started work, what time he left his house, that had no significance
that
to us.
That just means they're ignorant about the law, right?
Well, ignorant about the law in the sense that if you allow them to bail themselves out later, that they stumbled onto a basis for probable cause, that's indistinguishable from making an arrest and then after the fact finding stuff in the trunk. They
what
didn't know
the,
it.
What about an objective reasonableness? If a reasonable officer knew what they knew, which they did know, it was over an hour, would that be enough to say that they did have an objective reason, the officer would have had a reason to arrest him?
And then you get into a debate about what does it mean to know something. If they tell you, we didn't put any...
You don't know why they knew it, they just knew it. They knew what time they picked him up and they knew what time he had to be at work.
The analogy that we draw is that's like saying they searched somebody and they put their hands in their pocket and they felt something and they thought it was a comb, but it turns out much after the bogus arrest that it was a rock of cocaine. They knew something was in the pocket, but they missed it.
Well,
they didn't realize it until after the fact.
I think you actually have two different issues. In the case of your comb and your rock and so on, they know there's something in the pocket. They don't know what it is. With regard to the hour business, they know that it took more than an hour for him to get to work. They didn't know the legal significance. They're just ignorant about the law, but they know the fact. And that's why I think the waiver issue is important. But on the second thing, the TAN card, I think you have a stronger argument because they didn't actually know he didn't have a TAN card.
That's exactly.
Because not being interested in the question, I don't blame them. Chicago gun laws are incomprehensible, but not being interested in it, they never bothered to look for it. Isn't that your argument?
Exactly, Your Honor. You can't know something if you don't know, that is there to look for. And that obviously was not as troubling to the district court, and it's not as troubling to your honors, but I'd like to return then to the one-hour rule, since that is something that you're raising, and obviously the district court accepted it. The fact that it was never raised below, your honors, and was never asserted by the police officers as their justification, and then for the district court to seize on that, even though it wasn't even in their Rule 56 motion, wasn't in their interrogatory answers, puts plaintiff in an untenable position, because we didn't do discovery on the issue of when he left, when this arrest happened, because they never, we moved to compel them to answer an interrogatory, tell us why you made this arrest, and they left out the one-hour rule. And there are ways you can prove how long before he had to be at work this arrest happened, and it was obviously very close, because Mr. Haywood testified he had to be at work at 8:45. He testified he left his house sometime after 7:30. So we could have found the event queries, the police reports, et cetera, which are other documents which could have bared on this question. But by them not making it an issue in the litigation,
do we know? I suppose we know his address and the address of the work. They're both in Chicago, aren't they?
Correct, Your Honor.
So is the idea of the one-hour rule that you can go anywhere within Chicago in an hour? Is that the idea?
The way I read the statute is you're allowed to carry a gun if you're within a one-hour window between your home and your workplace.
And that would always be true if you live and work in Chicago. Is that the idea?
That's my idea.
I don't know, but
That's the way I understand it. You can't carry a gun, except there are exceptions, and one of the exceptions is if you're going to work.
Now, what happens if normally, you know, you live 10 minutes from work, but there's an accident or you know, some disaster of some sort, so you don't get there. Is this strict liability, criminal responsibility?
I would assume a justification or, you know, an extraordinary circumstances defense could apply.
But we haven't had that here.
Partly because
that hasn't been explored.
Partly because, you know, it wasn't an issue until it was the last day of our case. You know, it never came up until the district court sent us their order.
So there's been no consideration in the district court of possible justifications or excuses for the 1 hour?
In light of the fact that the district court, sua sponte, raised this issue by itself, the parties certainly weren't called to address that.
Wasn't he going to take his mother to vote?
There's a dispute in the factual record. He denies it. They say he said he's taking my mother to vote, but that's a summary judgment issue. And if you look at the summary judgment record here, they're claiming at their depositions, we knew all about the TAN card. We had this conversation with them. If you don't got a TAN card, you're not legit. The fact is, none of the contemporaneous documentation mentions the TAN card. They all talk about the registration, and only a jury can decide if they're telling the truth. He should have been able to go to a jury on this claim, as well as this first claim. And unless there are more questions, I'd like to reserve my time for a
moment. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lawler.
Thank you.
Ms. Worth?
May it please the court. During a validly executed traffic stop, police officers discovered that Mr. Haywood was in possession of two loaded and concealed firearms. This morning I will explain that although Mr. Haywood claims that he was entitled to carry those firearms, the police officers had probable cause to arrest him. And second, I will explain that the impropriety during the Gerstein hearing that Mr. Haywood complains of does not amount to a Fourth Amendment violation.
Well, are you now conceding an impropriety? Because in your brief, you said you indicated you thought it was fine, this procedure of the Chicago police.
Your Honor, I'm not conceding that it's true that the signature was improper. Officer Maras improperly signed Officer Moroz's signature. But I'm not conceding that that violated the Franks test for impropriety. Under Franks...
Well, now you have me lost, because you say the signature was improper, but the affidavit was not improper.
The falsehood is improper for Franks purposes, only if it is material. Your Honor, in Frank's...
I don't understand how it can't be material. That is, the way to pose the materiality question, suppose the prosecutor, whoever appeared before the magistrate, had handed him an unsigned affidavit. Wouldn't the magistrate have raised a question about that?
The judicial determination of whether...
You're not answering my question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, your question...
My question is, suppose the officers or the prosecutor, whoever appeared for the city before the magistrate, the Gerstein hearing, had handed the magistrate an unsigned affidavit. Wouldn't the magistrate have raised questions about that?
No.
Or would he have said, oh, fine, affidavits, they're good even if they're not signed?
The magistrate would not have raised questions about that, Your Honor, because...
Then why do you bother with these false signatures if you don't need a signature on an affidavit?
Well, there is
Well, so you surprised me, your previous answer. I can't believe a magistrate would simply accept an unsigned affidavit.
Your Honor, the...
That's a contradiction in terms. I mean, what is it? It's an affidavit form that doesn't have a signature.
As long as...
I did this, I did that, and you don't know who it is.
As long as the contents of the affidavit are accurate... For purposes of Frank...
No, the question is, what would the magistrate say? He gets an affidavit and says, I arrested this fellow and I saw his two guns and this and that and the other thing, but there's no signature. So there's no name. So the magistrate doesn't know, what's going on here. So,
well, at the Gerstein hearing, if the police officer is present and... is there to testify about what's in the affidavit, the fact that there is no signature is not material for Frank's purposes. The materiality issue in Frank's is basically, Your Honor, a term of art. It means that if the judicial officer knew the truth...
But you're saying an application for a warrant requires that it be attested, doesn't it?
Yes.
So how is it you have a lower requirement for a warrant than for holding a person, after he's been arrested?
We explain in our brief, Your Honor, that the Oath and Affirmation Clause of the Fourth Amendment goes only to the issuance of warrants. But in this case, besides all that, there was a sworn affidavit and a sworn testimony here. It was falsely sworn, but...
That's an extraordinary argument. I saw that in your brief. You say, as long as it's sworn, it doesn't matter if it's falsely sworn. I just don't understand
Let me just clarify. It does matter that it's falsely sworn.
How does it matter?
Well, it's not something that we condone. The city of Chicago certainly doesn't.
On the contrary, you are planning to continue, as judging from your brief, you believe this is an okay practice, which will continue.
No, Your Honor, we do not believe it's an okay practice.
You defend it on the grounds of convenience, because, sometimes the officer who made the arrest is not going to be available in court. Nowhere do you suggest in your brief that you regard this as an improper practice which should not be followed by your officers.
Well, let me make it clear that we do regard it as an improper practice.
Why didn't you say it in your brief?
Well, we put up our 30B witness who testified quite clearly, Your Honor, that this is not the policy of the city of Chicago to sign the complaints in this way. He made it quite clear that this is wrong and not condoned by the city of Chicago. There is evidence in the record showing that the city has never condoned this practice, and I regret this happened, but the fact that this signature was not of the police officer who purported to sign it...
But of course, if we condone it, it's obviously going to continue.
It's not going to continue, Your Honor.
It's going to continue because it's easier, and you want us to say it's lawful and none of our business, so it'll go on.
Well, the police department will make sure.
No, it won't. It has no incentive to once we say it's a legal practice.
The question, Your Honor, is not whether this is legal under the Illinois laws or the laws of the city. Of course, we don't allow this. It is not condoned by us. The question is whether this practice has violated the Fourth Amendment. And in Franks, and let me get back to that again, in Franks, the court has made it clear that a falsehood, it puts aside and negates probable cause only if it is intentional and if it is material to the finding of the probable cause. And materiality under Franks, Your Honor, means that if the judicial officer knew the truth, would that negate probable cause? Now, in this case, even if the state court judge, the judicial officer at the Gerstein hearing, even if he knew that Officer Maras had falsely, although with permission, signed Officer Moroza's signature, the question is, would that make a difference to his finding of probable cause?
You say on page 39, bottom of your brief, you say, as the Haywood suggestion throughout that there's something nefarious about Officer Maris signing his partner's name in the complaint, there is no rule of Fourth Amendment law that precludes a police officer from signing another officer's name. Here, the use of this procedural shortcut was in the service of convenience. Well, that sounds to me as if you're saying this is a perfectly good practice.
No, Your Honor. In fact, if that's what it sounds like I'm saying, I'll retract that. What I'm saying in my brief is that this is what occurred in this case. It was done by this police officer as a matter of convenience because he knew that his partner was the one who was going to be present at the hearing. I do not mean to suggest by this that this is something that the city condones or that we agree should continue to be done. In fact, our witness who testified on behalf of the city's policy made very clear that this is not the city's policy, that we do not approve of these practices and that these practices are looked down upon. So to the extent that my brief in any way suggest to this court that we think it's a good idea for police officers to falsely sign each other's names, I will respectfully say that that is not the case.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you about the probable cause issue? This hour and a half thing, you did waive that, didn't you?
No, Your Honor, we did not waive it. It was in our Rule 56 statement. We have identify facts that support that the arrest was made no later.
Did you argue to the district judge that the arrest was justified because of the one-hour rule?
We did not, but the district.
Well, it's not a waiver. That is, you have to make because as Mr. Lovey said, maybe there are justifications, defenses, issues, timing, facts. Who knows what that he might have wanted to present to the district judge if the district judge hadn't plucked this ground out of a hat.
First, Your Honor, I don't think the district judge plucked this out of the
hat.
Well,
you didn't argue that it was a justification for the arrest, what business did he have thinking up a ground for arrest that the city hadn't thought of? I don't understand that.
Well, the district court was justified in ruling on a ground that was completely supported by the record.
No, that's not the way we do it. I mean, people are permitted to waive valid grounds. If a plaintiff comes in and says, I'm entitled to judgment on grounds 1, 2, and 3, and the defendant opposes 1, 2, and 3, and the judge says, well, actually, there's no base for 1, 2, and 3, but I've thought of ground 4, which the plaintiff didn't think of. So I thought of it, and on that basis, I'm awarding judgment to the plaintiff. Now, wouldn't we regard that as highly improper? Or do you want to defend that?
Well, even if it were,
we do have concepts of waiver, and if you don't advance a ground for judgment, That's out. It's way.
Your Honor, it's not as if Mr. Haywood did not have an opportunity to address this.
Why would he address a ground that wasn't raised? Look, you don't have a situation where the plaintiff raised three grounds and the defendant says not only are those three grounds unsound, but there are 10 other grounds that the plaintiff might have raised and they're unsound also.
But Mr. Haywood admitted to all of the facts that are in the Rule 56 statement, and those facts include facts to the effect that the arrest took place outside that one-hour window. Moreover, Mr. Haywood never complained, Your Honor, when the district court ruled on the one-hour basis. He was always free to file a motion for reconsideration.
But there's no duty to file a motion for reconsideration to correct an error by a district judge. You always have the option there's no mandatory, Rule 59E procedure.
No.
Strictly optional.
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. But the point is that there was nothing that Mr. Haywood could show, given that he had admitted.
Well, we don't know that. Probably you're right. But shouldn't we leave that to the district judge to give them a chance to respond? They had no chance to respond in the district court.
I understand your concern, Your Honor. But once Mr. Haywood admitted the salient facts in connection with the one-hour rule issue, there's not much that he could do to go back and attack the district court's ruling on that ground. But
that's not how we do things.
Well,
I
understand that, Your Honor, but let me just move away from the one-hour rule for just a moment and explain that, of course, there was probable cause to arrest Mr. Haywood anyway.
Well, I don't get that either, because I don't see how you can say they didn't know he didn't have a tan card. They had no interest in a tan card, so.
Well, to begin with, Your Honor, there is evidence in the record, undisputed, that in fact they did know about the tan card. And I just want to clear that up. I think, Judge Posner, you had earlier suggested that there seemed to be no issue that they didn't know about the tan card, but that's not true. Actually, there is no issue that the officers knew about the tan card. They testified about that in their deposition, and Mr. Haywood has not been able to refute their deposition testimony. The only thing Mr. Haywood has pointed to is that the officer's report does not mention a tan card. Well, the officer's report is merely a narrative of what occurred. It doesn't purport to be everything that they that was a legal justification for what they were doing. That doesn't refute the officer's testimony that they knew about the tan card. But apart from that, of course, the standard for a probable cause is an objective one. It doesn't matter what.
That's fine, but it has to be something they know, and I don't think they knew that.
Well, they have to know.
They didn't know he had it. Yes, but one, it is a fact whether he had a tan card or didn't have a tan card, and I don't think they knew he had it. He didn't have a tan card.
Whether or not, first, as I said, there is evidence to show that they knew, and it's unrefuted evidence. But even if there were a genuine issue as to whether, may I complete my thoughts, Your Honor?
Yeah,
my time is up. There is no genuine issue that Mr. Haywood showed the officers what he claimed was all the required documents necessary to carry those two firearms. There is also no dispute that the officers looked through all the paperwork that Mr. Haywood offered for them to look at, and that paperwork did not contain the requisite document, the tan card. Under those facts, and under the objective standard of probable cause, the officers had probable cause to arrest him under the Illinois statute of unlawful use of weapons.
What does it show? What is its role in this whole thing? I found the district court's opinion, frankly, a little muddled on that.
The tan card, Your Honor, is the card or the document that authorizes properly licensed security guards to carry weapons back and forth from their place of business and home within certain rules, certain limitations, and one of those limitations is the one-hour limitation.
The weapons still have to be registered under state law?
Yes.
So if your weapon is registered under state law, the TAN card allows the officer to carry it without doing what? What makes it different?
TAN card is simply an additional document that allows registered security guards to actually carry the weapon on their person while traveling. The registration card doesn't allow that. The registration card, you have to register weapons that you possess in the state of Illinois and also under Chicago ordinance, but that doesn't allow one to carry loaded, concealed firearms back and forth while traveling in a vehicle.
And there are other provisions, are there, so that other individuals can carry a loaded, concealed firearm?
There are many other provisions. For instance, of course, the police officers can carry loaded and concealed firearms and so on. And there is this security guard provision that says that if you're a security guard properly licensed and you have the proper documents, and that's the TAN card, you may do so, and even then, it has very strict limitations on how it must be done, and the one-hour rule is one of those limitations.
Now, the one-hour rule requires what? Requires the travel time be 1 hour between your home and your place of employment?
The way the one-hour rule reads, Your Honor, is that the person actually engaged, and I'm reading this from the exception to the to the statute, the security guard exception. It allows individuals to carry the firearms while actually engaged in the performance of the duties of their employment or commuting between their homes and place of employment, provided that such commuting is accomplished within 1 hour from departure from home or place of employment, as the case may be.
All right, now, that ordinance doesn't say that the officer has to time his commute so that he shows up exactly at his start time at the office, does it?
No, it doesn't say that.
He's allowed to show up at time to maybe go change his shirt or punch in or even get himself a cup of coffee before he actually goes on patrol, right?
I'm sure he can.
Okay.
I think the purpose of the one-hour rule is to ensure that people don't use this exception.
Right.
To meander around doing other things.
Well, what happens if you have an accident or some other emergency, so it takes more than an hour?
Well, sure, Your Honor, as counsel also conceded, that there could be exceptions made in those circumstances. If the person could show that they were in fact involved in an accident and therefore were not able to be at work within the hour, surely they would...
Would it even be relevant? It seems to me, doesn't this ordinance basically say you have to live an hour's commute from home, within an hour's commute from your job?
Exactly.
Does he live within an hour's commute of his job?
I'm not sure I know that, Your Honor, and I don't think the record exactly shows that.
Wouldn't that be something to explore?
Well, I think he does. I mean, he lives on the south side, Inglewood, and he works in a pawn shop in Chicago, and there's never been any issue, anything raised that he doesn't live within the 1 hour, and certainly the statute seems to require...
That's probably why they didn't arrest him for this, right?
Well, they arrested him, Your Honor, based on the objective...
Right, but they probably, even if they knew about the one-hour rule, they probably thought, well, you know, they knew the address and so on. That's within an hour. It's not as if he's commuting to Detroit or something.
Well, perhaps they didn't arrest him for the one-hour rule because
Well, we know they didn't arrest him for that.
No, perhaps that was the reason. We don't know.
Right.
We do know that they
didn't violate the... For all we know, he didn't actually violate the one-hour rule.
Well, the facts show that he did. The undisputed facts in our rule...
Well, he never got to work that day, so how do we know when he was going to arrive?
He was supposed to arrive at 9.
Well, yes, but that's Judge Ripple's question. You know, look, you could have a situation, you do at 9, but you know about the one-hour rule, so you always come early. And maybe you come early for other reasons, you know, you have breakfast or something. show up early.
All right, but putting the one-hour rule aside, Your Honor, there can be little question that there was probable cause to arrest Mr. Hayward for...
What would you do with a case like this? Suppose you have a short-sighted policeman. So he arrests someone and he doesn't actually have any reason to do so. He just did it. But if he had 30/20 vision, he would have seen that the person he arrested was carrying a rock of cocaine in his left hand. Now, would you say that would be a situation which there was an objective basis for the arrest?
No.
So how is this different? Some of a very alert policeman who went through this fellow's pockets, his records, his papers, would have noticed a missing tan card. But these people didn't notice the missing tan card either, because they're not careful. I mean, this is if you resolve the facts in favor of the plaintiffs. They didn't know. They didn't know the tan card was missing. They didn't know anything about a tan card. How can you have an unconscious awareness of a fact? That's what you're really saying. They knew he didn't. If you'd asked them whether he had a tan card, they would have said, "We don't know."
Your Honor, the point is, and the reason why this is different from the hypothetical you raised a moment ago, is that these officers knew. They had information that this person these officers knew that he was carrying a concealed
weapon. What they do is he turns over a bunch of documents. They look through the documents, and they don't actually know that he doesn't have a tan card, because that's if you accept his version of the fact. Because they don't know the legal significance of a tan card. It's not that they know he was scheduled to arrive at 9 and so on, and it was 7:30 when he left. They knew that, didn't know the legal significance. But I don't think they knew he didn't have a tan card, because they just weren't interested in that.
Well, even if one accepts the plaintiff's version that they didn't know about the tan card or the legal significance of the tan card, it does...
Those are two separate questions. Of course they know the legal... But I don't think they knew... I don't think there's evidence, or solid evidence, that he didn't have a tan card. For all they knew, he had one, and they hadn't shown it to them because...
I disputed that he did not possess a tan card.
Of course we know that he didn't possess it, but what did they know? What did they know? Did they know that he had a Medicare card, for example?
Well, Your Honor, the test...
Well, did they?
Well, no. About a Medicaid card? No, of course not.
Because, they wouldn't have known that, because it wasn't anything of interest to them.
But the point is...
They happened to find out by accident about the hour, because they called to find out whether he's really employed by the pawn shop. So that's how they actually knew a fact about the hour. But I don't think they knew a fact about whether he had or didn't have a tan card.
They knew, as a matter of fact, that Mr. Hayward claimed to be a security guard, and he claimed that he had all the required documents in his possession. And he offered the police officers to go through the documents. That is undisputed. It is also undisputed that amongst those documents, there was no tan card.
Right, we know that.
So the facts that were known to them were that he claimed to be a security guard. He claimed to have all the documents.
Suppose there was no Medicare card either. Did they know there was no Medicare card?
Well, the Medicare card doesn't come into the picture, because Mr. Hayward...
Well, it comes to show them. I'm just asking, did they know as a fact that he didn't have a Medicare card?
I don't know that, Your Honor, and I don't think...
I'm assuming he didn't. Assume he didn't have a Medicare card. Did they know he didn't have a Medicare card?
No.
Did they look through all his pockets or whatever they did?
Your Honor, if you'll just allow me, the Mr. Hayward claimed to have all the documents necessary for carrying those firearms. A medical card is not necessary for carrying firearms. Mr. Hayward said, look,
the court had supposed it were. If it were somehow, if you have a Medicare card, you can't carry a gun, you're too old. Suppose that's the law in Chicago. So then you would say, well, if he didn't have a Medicare card, there would be an objective.
Yes, then I would.
They would know that.
Then I would say that, because if it were the law that the that he were required to show a Medicare card or carry a Medicare card in order to carry those weapons, then when he said to the police officers, here, I have all the required documents in my possession that allow me to carry these weapons, and here they are, you're welcome to look at them, then, yes, if a Medicare card were one of such documents and that were missing at that time, yes, then that would be a fact that
okay.
We know about.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Worth.
Thank
Mr.
you,
Lovey,
Your Honor.
How much time does he have? 5 minutes?
I'd like to return to the waiver point briefly, because I think Your Honor has nailed it, that not putting in the summary judgment motion should be the end of it, but there's really a second layer of waiver here, and that's the interrogatory response. And they thought it was clever at the time when they got moved to compel an interrogatory thing, why did you arrest them? And they said, well, see our report. And now they have to live with that answer, because that's what shaped discovery. So it's not only a waiver on the summary judgment, but it's a waiver in the litigation. That's the discovery that we did. It was shaped by what they're telling us is the basis for their probable cause. So it's really a double waiver. As far as the missing tan card, I think counsel is just simply mistaken. When she says there is evidence, they knew there wasn't a tan card. She cites to their deposition. And for that matter, they attached affidavits to the summary judgment motion, too, saying we knew all along. Their deposition has that silly testimony saying that, oh, we had a whole conversation with them about the tan card. What they're missing is, for Rule 56 purposes, we don't have to accept that. In their arrest report, they said we picked them up for a bad registration. When they were called upon to explain this arrest in the OPS statement, they said we got them for a bad registration. So nobody has to credit their testimony that they knew all along about the missing tan card, and that's why this is a summary judgment case. I think Your Honors have appropriately raised questions as to whether he even did violate the one-hour rule, but as we know, since this wasn't an issue in the case ever, those questions remain unexplored. As far as the greater Fourth Amendment issue, that's the manner in which they had Mr. Hayward detained based on a fraudulent document, it seems to me, hearing what I heard, that she is conceding you can't do that. And if that's the case, there's nothing left to argue.
Well, but her argument is, yes, you can't do it, but it didn't make a difference, because if the magistrate had known, since the other officer was there, he would have said, oh, well, it doesn't matter. I have the false affidavit, which does contain information, however, and I have the co-arresting officer here to testify, so that's all I need.
Well, ironically, you know, that's an issue that Judge Cannelli addressed on the motion to dismiss. And he said quite eloquently, would a hypothetical judge, upon learning what happened here, deem this not material? He said, there's no way. A judge that found out he got misled by a bogus affidavit would find that material. And in response to the hypothetical posed, if there was a police officer in the room saying, okay, this is a bogus affidavit, but I can give you an independent basis for probable cause, that's not this case.
Oh, the other officer wasn't there?
Nobody was there.
I thought the idea was that the reason... Well, I can't keep it. Morris, is that his name? Who's the one who signed?
Maristine Morose is his name.
Maristine Morose. Maristine Morose's name. Well, I thought he did it on the theory that Morose was going to be in court.
What is undisputed for purposes of appeal is that nobody was present at the Gerstein hearing. The only thing before the judge was the bogus affidavit.
So a prosecutor goes in with the affidavit or a police officer goes in?
Exactly.
Who goes in?
We have a short transcript. I believe it's the prosecutor. I can't say.
No,
for
it's
sure.
A lawyer merely hands the affidavit to the.
And it's decided on the papers. So they're describing a hypothetical that is not this case. And if they, you know, if they had wanted to show up, that would be a different question. But they didn't want to show up. In the interest of convenience, they just wanted to get this done. And what they did here is unconstitutional.
So am I correct? The real problem is that perhaps the officer who actually wrote out the affidavit and forged his colleague's name to it. That guy may have a credibility quotient with this magistrate judge of zip, zero.
Another way of looking
okay.
at the question.
So when the but he puts his views before the magistrate judge under the label of his colleague's name. So the magistrate judge is misled because the magistrate judge never gets a chance to assess the credibility of that affidavit on its face. That magistrate judge would have a right to say, I don't accept anything from this lying son of a gun.
Sure. And the way I do it, that's a totally independent reason to refuse.
So that is so in effect, it is a false representation of
yours. I think so, Your Honor. In addition to the fact that they perpetrated a fraud on the court and should lose on that reason alone. And they say that their 30B6 witness tells you that it's not our policy, but of course, for summary judgment purposes, we got all kinds of evidence that this is exactly their policy, that it happens over and over again, hundreds of arrests, that this guy says he's been in different districts, and this is how it's done. And he's never heard from a supervisor that you shouldn't do it this way. And in discovery, we were aggressive, asking where are the policies that, we got no policies governing this. So we can prove in this case that there is a practice of doing exactly this. And Your Honor should weigh in, and you should tell them that they should stop. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel. Next case for argument is...